Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Welcome to Dunzo. This is a podcast that explores hookups and breakups of famous lovers and friends, both real and fake, and all the discarded pop culture of yesteryear. I'm your host, Troy McKeady. You guys, welcome to another episode of Dunzo. It is me, Troy McKeady, and I am joined by a new guest today. I am very excited for this because he's actually low-key one of my favorite YouTube channels. So I'm like geeking out kind of a little bit. But I'm joined today by Matt Baum. Did I say it right?
Yes, you did. Boom. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh my God. I'm so happy that you're here. Your YouTube channel has always been one of the things that I send to people. Like whenever somebody's looking for like a fun, like deep divey, like something to get lost in that they can watch like a million videos in a row, your channel is so great for that. And I really want you to tell my listeners like what you do.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. So on my channel, I talk about pop culture history to do some storytelling about the making of behind the scenes stories, particularly as it relates to what was going on with queer stuff behind the scenes and in real life. So, you know, essentially my channel is about how the queer content on television and in movies and media also reflects the real life story of queer people's lives out in the world, the actual stories of our lives.
Yeah, and I got really excited when we, when I had messaged you about doing this, I was like, you know, just send me like we'll do like a short list of shows like to talk about, you know, and the list that you sent me was identical to what I was hoping you would send. It was like,
right,
The Nanny, Golden Girls, Will and Grace. There was some Ellen content on there. I was like, okay, yes, this is the conversation I was hoping to have. And yeah, I'm just excited to get into it. I figured we could kind of look at some examples of shows that handled queerness in like a really positive way, or at least I would say just kind of based on your videos, if not positive, at least well-meaning, well-intended, sure. You know?
Yeah. There's some, their hearts were in the right place kind of shows. I think a great example of that, for example, is Rock, which had the first that we know of televised same-sex commitment ceremony in American primetime. And it's really a positive depiction, although the terminology is not exactly what we use today. But, you know, it's one of those where, like, they did a good job. It was actually good. We wouldn't do it exactly the same way today. But, yeah. Hey, you know, times change.
Exactly. Yeah, times change. And also, I wanted to talk about some not-so-great examples, either because of how poorly they handled it on the show or how intensely negatively it was received by the public. I would say Ellen is a great example of that, where I'm like, that is something that still, I mean, I'll be telling my therapist about the response to Ellen coming out when I'm 90, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that was a real, I mean, hot button issue. Hard to exaggerate just how intensely people responded. Like, it was such a big news item at the time in a way that we just, you know, don't do today with sitcom. Like, it's hard to imagine a sitcom being so important to people today as it was back then.
Yeah, so I want to start with what I would say, and I feel like you would agree with me. I won't put words in your mouth, but I feel like you might agree. I would say the crowning jewel example of how to handle queerness on television, especially during a time in the 90s when people are freaking out about the AIDS crisis and things like that, is The Nanny. Mm-hmm. I think Fran Drescher is really just, it really doesn't get any better to me.
She's wonderful. And I think a lot of the credit there goes to her, to Fran Drescher, and to the folks that she was working with, in particular her husband, who later came out as gay. But even, you know, at the time, when you look at what was happening on television, there was a lot of like, it was still a time of like gay disgust, like, oh, that's, you know, they, I don't think they even used the word queer at that time, but oh, that's pretty gay, or oh, lesbian, that's scary. And then the thing that sets The Nanny apart is just how nonchalant and matter of fact that gay people are just a part of her life. No big deal, to an extent that she maybe didn't realize at the time. But there's a great episode where she meets a guy and just assumes that he's gay because they have a good rapport. He likes shopping. He knows about Broadway. And when she discovers that he's straight, that really changes their relationship, but not because she's like, gay, that's controversial. She's just like, oh, now you're available for me to have a crush on because you're straight.
Yes.
You know, it's very different from like, oh no, this person's gay, what do we do? Like you'd see on The Simpsons. And I think The Simpsons episode with John Waters is fantastic, but, that's certainly a much more, anxious response. Same thing on Designing Women, the episode Suzanne goes looking for a friend. You know, you see somebody being like, uh-oh, there's a gay person here. It's a crisis. What do we do about it?
Yeah, it's funny that you bring up The Simpsons, because I would almost say that like the Smithers of it all is like representative of what it meant to be a gay character on TV at the time, where like it's always sort of questioned but not directly, and there are jokes around it but like not maybe always directly, you know, it's like Smithers having a doll collection, things like that, where it's like they're, you know, they're coding this person to be gay, and whether it's a good or bad thing is like up for debate. I mean, I guess it depends on the day, you know. Like that Simpsons episode, I love the episode, but it's so odd, its placement in that show, because it doesn't feel like it fits with the tone of the rest of The Simpsons to me. Like Homer's gay panic, but it's like, it's the freaking 90s, you know?
You know, I think I have a couple thoughts there. One is I'm willing to give The Simpsons a little bit more of a pass on Smithers, in part because that show is so much so often a commentary on previous media. And I think Smithers is very much a parody, often, not always, a parody of a type of character that you would see much more frequently in decades past, particularly when the writers of The Simpsons at that time would have been kids watching television.
Yeah.
You know, and seeing, for example, I don't know why this is the first example that springs to mind, but seeing the Nancy Walker show, which had a gay best friend character, and Smithers really slots into that, or fits into that slot. That having been said, I agree with you that Homer's panic about John does feel, on one hand, a little out of left field. Like, why does he care so much? At the same time, I don't think it's so alien that a character like Homer would be surprised or taken aback. Or, you know, it's just not, you know, something explicitly gay, someone who's just openly gay, just not a part of his life at that time. And you know, he does feel a little more, I think, in that episode Homer does occasionally feel a little more like, I don't know, he feels more like an Al Bundy somehow.
Oh, that's such a good comparison.
But I don't think it's totally like, I don't think it wrecks Homer's character. Like, you know, he's right. An idiot. Homer's an idiot, and that he's having an idiotic response is, you know, that's as in keeping with Homer's personality as, you know, suing the all you can eat buffet because they kicked him out after he ate all the food. It's not so different.
No, you're totally right. You're right. It is. It's very on par with something that you describe in a lot of your videos, with like this sort of like that like scream reaction of somebody finding out in a sitcom that somebody's gay in the 80s or 90s, or like, you know, that sort of like wide-eyed moment where they're like, he's gay, you know, like that happens so much.
I love it. I miss that, honestly. Like, I don't miss being like a subject of horror, but
right,
I miss the moment that I often refer to as, I can't believe it's not heterosexual, when, and you know, it's just something that occurs basically from the 70s to the 90s. I don't think I've seen it after 2000, I don't think I've ever seen it. But you see it on All in the Family. You see it on even on the Golden Girls. You see it on Designing Women. You see it on, for sure, that like scream. There's a moment on Murphy Brown where they're shocked that a coworker, where some of them are shocked that a coworker might be gay. And I do kind of love that, like, we have that power over the straights.
Yes, I know. I know. And that iconic line that doesn't exist anymore. Well, I guess it does, but you don't hear it as often. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean,
yeah,
that is
exactly
so quintessential 90s sitcom. You know, it's like, God, I'm not judging, but, you know, like that whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I think that line's really important because I just released a Seinfeld video where I think it's really important to note that in that episode, previously, you would often see a character responding to gay, you know, wanting to distance themselves from whatever was gay. And in that episode, what you're seeing is a tension of them wanting to distance themselves from homophobia. They're very quick, and they acknowledge that they are freaked out by whatever gay thing is around them. But for the first time, they're acknowledging, oh, that's, but we shouldn't express, that's not acceptable to express.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great episode too, by the way.
It is really, like, I think it holds up well. I think it endures really well. It is, there are aspects of it that are dated, like their agitation over something.
Yeah, yes.
But, you know, it's certainly not one of those where you're like, I often compare that to WKRP or the episode Less on the Ledge from the late 70s. Where the character Les wants to throw himself off of a building when someone thinks he's gay.
Oh my God.
15 years earlier. And you really like the change from one to the other is real remarkable.
Well, before we gallivant too far away from the nanny, because you and I feel like we could do what we're doing right now for 7 straight hours. I can already tell that.
Zoom. Yeah. I'll load the schedule.
I think that the nanny is also a really great example of what it looks like to have queer people writing a show, you know, and like these aren't old, you know, middle-aged straight men trying to sort of figure out how to write this in some artistic way that doesn't offend middle America but is still not pro gay people. It's just, it's a queer voice and you can hear it, like you can feel it, you can hear it, it just feels so authentic. I think that's the thing that separates the nanny from so many shows that like covered this.
You know, I agree with that. I think so much of the nanny is her, it's Fran. Like there's, it's such a, it is weird to say autobiographical in the sense that like not the details but the voice is so authentically Fran Drescher's. And you know, that I don't know that Mark Jacobson was out to even himself at that time, but his presence there I'm sure had an impact. And yeah, I don't know that much about the private lives, the personal lives of the writers of The Nanny. But I mean, the gay stuff that we see does feel very, you know, it's written from a place of real affection and empathy, you know. Yeah. Obviously, there have been queer folks working in television since the beginning.
Yes, absolutely.
But it does feel like there was perhaps less resistance to, you know, allowing them or their perspective into the writer's room. And I don't know if that happened because the writers were queer, maybe they're closeted, maybe they just knew queer people, but I agree. Authenticity is definitely the word I would use to describe the, you know, the depictions there on the episode where she meets a guy who turns out to be straight, on the episode where there's a queer woman who Fran was trying to, who assumed was trying to get with Mr. Sheffield.
So good.
That's another one where the actress, it's kind of a weird coming out. But once again, like the reaction to it is exactly what a queer person would want, which is, that's great.
Yeah, totally. Totally, absolutely. Good for you. You know what I mean? And I also love the moment in that episode where Fran is like, she's like contemplating, like, could I date this woman? You know, like, it's just great. But you're right, though. I think the thing that show does better than any show that I feel like I've seen you cover is that it handles it as a non-factor. It is not a story arc. I mean, it can be a story arc, but it's not like the, it's not the, what's the word I'm looking for? Like the wrench in the episode, if you will. It's not like the thing that's like, do you know what I'm trying to say? It's not like clogging the pipe, if you will.
Crisis of the week. Yeah.
Yeah. Crisis of the week. Exactly.
even on the Golden Girls, you see that, you know, and I think the Golden Girls, like, I think they handle it great. But when mm-hmm. when Dorothy's friend Jean shows up, it's what do we do about this queer person in our midst?
Yeah.
And when Blanche's brother shows up twice, it's what do we do about this queer person?
Let's talk about then, Golden Girls.
Yeah. Yes, please.
Let's talk about Blanche's brother.
What a fascinating character. Clayton. Yeah. Played by Monty Markham.
So interesting the way that they chose to cover that, and the fact that the story developed, like he came back and they added this extra layer to the story where it was like, I guess you could explain the narrative of what their relationship was better than me.
Yeah, they really did a great job of deepening him. You know, we seldom see recurring queer characters at that time. It happened a few times, you know, it happened on All in the Family, notably with Beverly LaSalle, who's this wonderful character. And they did something similar where every time she appears, her character is deepened a bit more. With Clayton on the Golden Girls, the situation is that Blanche has a brother who she does not realize is gay until he comes for a visit, comes out to Rose, in part because Blanche is trying to set her brother up with women. And, you know, he senses, I guess, in Rose, somebody, a sympathetic ear, comes out to her, and she coaches him to come out to Blanche. And he does. She doesn't respond well at first, but she grows to accept him over the course of the episode. But the thing that she still seems to have some growth to do, a subject that she still seems to have some growth to do on, is him dating. Because he comes back a year or two later and he brings a partner, and she is absolutely not prepared to accept that. She can accept him, but she can't accept that he's dating, which, you know, really means that she can't accept him because dating is a part of his life and his partner is a part of his life. So it's great that we have this opportunity to visit with the character when he comes for the first episode, to see a family member learn to, you know, that, oh, this person has revealed something about themselves. This changes our relationship potentially. But at the end of the day, he's still the same person. And my feelings for him, you know, I have an obligation as a family member to support them. So we see that whole process in episode one. And then a year or two later, we see a much more complicated process when he says that he plans to marry the man he loves. And Blanche doesn't understand until Sophia takes her aside and says, well, why did you marry? She says to Blanche, why did you marry George? And Blanche's response is, we loved each other. We wanted to make a commitment in front of the whole world. And suddenly the you know, the light goes on that, oh, that's what everybody wants. And, you know, I think we could debate the whether everybody wants to get married, because that isn't always the solution for everybody. You know, that isn't necessarily the end point to a relationship. But I think we can recognize the importance of honoring someone's decision to marry, you know, whether it's a man or a woman. And that's what Blanche gets to at the end of the episode. We really see everybody make some growth.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that they chose to sort of take it in this direction of, you don't realize what you have in common. First of all, when you're that close to someone who feels like they can't fully be themselves, you are getting like a watered down version of their personality, of their identity, things that you could have in common, you don't know. And I liked that they approached it from the perspective of, now that he's out, she's realizing all along we're so much more similar than we even thought we were. Like, of course we're siblings, you know, we both love men. Like, we're both very sexual creatures and we both love men. And I love that. And I don't know, I just always thought Golden Girls, for being the show that it was and when it was on TV, I mean, it's even more wild. It's an 80s show, and the way that they chose to cover gay characters was always so heartfelt, and maybe not always politically correct, but you could feel that there was like a sympathy there for the gay community.
You know, I think a lot of the credit, there's a lot of credit to spread around for that. Part of it goes to Jeff Dutille, who wrote the episode with Dorothy's friend Jean coming for a visit. He actually wrote that on spec. He wasn't a staffer on the show, but he knew Winifred Hervey, who was one of the producers. I also think a lot of credit goes to Winifred Hervey, who is, you know, one of the more unspoken, or not unspoken, but she's not always credited with the success of the show. Because she's not, you know, a marquee name, but she was there, I think, for the entire run of it, or at least most of it. She brought Jeff Dutille. She bought his script when he submitted it. And she was also, I think it's important to note that she was Black. And I think that there's a real respect for minority voices and for disenfranchised people on the show that you might not have seen from other shows that were led by, you know, that would have had a showrunning team that was not as diverse as the Golden Girls.
God, and I know that it's debatable why gay people and why queer people feel such an intense connection to that show. And I think that it could be a whole number of things. Like, I remember, for me, being a young person, that was a show that really connected me to, like, my older female relatives. Mm. It was, like, this streamline. Like, I want to lay in bed and watch Golden Girls at 11 o'clock just as much as you, if not more. Mm-hmm. I'm going to sing the song and reach the same octave you're going to reach. Like, we're both enjoying this experience intensely, you know, and I'm not watching it just because you want to, and you're not watching it to, like, just because I want to. I really genuinely love this show, you know, and I don't know. And I also agree with the minority thing. There are so many interesting episodes on that show that deal with race. Mm-hmm. It's just such a, like, profoundly forward thinking show about a bunch of older women living in Florida. It's wild.
Isn't that amazing that it seems like it should be such a exclusionary show that, like, oh, this is a very specific point of view that we're telling the show from. But I think the universality of a lot of the issues that they deal with helps. Also, that the jokes are incredibly funny.
It's just for a so lot of that, sharp. You know,
I think Susan Harris gets a lot of credit for that, for creating such a powerful show. She had come from Soap and a few other programs prior that were also just brilliant. And then, of course, the talent. Everybody, it's one of those shows that's just absolutely cast completely perfectly. Yeah. And all of those women had connections to queer community and to queer actors and talent. So, you know, of course, they were unafraid to tackle those sorts of issues as they had prior to their, I think they all had been, yeah, they all had been in episodes or projects that had tackled queer issues. Bea Arthur on Maude, which had multiple queer characters. Obviously, Estelle Getty had been in Torch Song Trilogy on Broadway, which was huge. Rue McClanahan had done Some of My Best Friends Are, which was a movie set in a gay bar. And Betty White, of course, had done Love, Sydney, which was short-lived. I think it ran for 2 seasons, show on NBC. That was about a gay man. Although he was very, it really gives you a sense of where television was at the time. You could watch that entire series and not know that he was gay because they kept it so under wraps, you know, just unspoken. Oh, it's just a single man trying to make it in the big city. Yeah, I wonder why he doesn't have a girlfriend. I don't know. But, right. Anyway, it was a lot more explicit than the TV movie that it was based on.
Well, let's talk for a second about, I would love to hear your relationship to Will and Grace.
Mm. Yeah, that's it's an interesting one because when it was initially on, it sort of passed me by because I just started college, was not watching a lot of television at the time, but I knew that it was in the air. It was just something in the zeitgeist and that, you know, times being what they were, broadcast television was a lot more important to people's lives, even if you didn't watch. Mm-hmm. So I was certainly aware that television was getting a lot gayer. This was after the Ellen incident, after the puppy episode where she came out, which I did, you know, I watched that along with, you know, I think it was 40 million other people. Just huge viewership on that. Watch television get a little gayer for a little bit, and then Ellen went away. And so television felt a little less welcoming at the time. And then just knowing that the show was on, which I watched sporadically initially, but something about knowing that it was there really made it feel like, okay, we're not perhaps as forbidden and taboo as the almost immediate cancellation of Ellen might have you believe. There is a place for you outside of, you know, gay film festivals that you have to know a guy to know a guy to know when they're happening.
Yeah, Will and Grace is an interesting one because I remember as a really young person, that was like, there are certain things I look back on and they're kind of like, they're like, it was like my mom's tongue-in-cheek way of being like, babe, I know that you're gay and it's like, fine. Mm. Like, we're watching Will and Grace together every Thursday night. You are cackling. Like, you know, my mom is sitting there watching me literally on my knees, belly laughing. You know what I mean? At Will and Grace and like seeing myself in this show. And I'm like not putting it together that she like knows I'm gay, you know, whatever. That's a whole nother conversation. But Will and Grace was an interesting one because I just remember I had never really felt so seen by a television mm-hmm. show. I almost felt too seen. I was like, this is a little close to home. Like, this is wild. You know, it was so gay. And at that point, I don't remember ever having seen anything so gay. You know, mm-hmm. it almost felt like taboo to sit mm-hmm. with a room full of people, especially family members, and watch Will and Grace, you know? And to hear people's response to the show was also really interesting to me as like a young person, like seeing people be either repulsed by it or love it. I just always thought was really fascinating and like imprinted on me.
Well, this is why I think this stuff is so important. Sometimes people can be like, oh, it's just a sitcom, who cares? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that's really overlooking the importance of having something that's beaming into millions of homes. It's giving people an opportunity to talk about something they might not otherwise have talked about. Mm-hmm. And with sitcoms in particular, those tend to be the programs that are syndicated, and we see them again and again and again. And so there's a real staying power to those shows that, you know, for example, Dynasty or Starsky and Hutch is maybe a bad example because that one was syndicated. We did see it a lot. But, you know, other programs that you might not have seen quite so much, sitcoms are always there, and they're always there. Like once they enter that syndication period, every day at 5:30, you know, you're going to see this with Will and Grace. There's going to be something gay every day for you to watch. And mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with being seen in a way that previously you might have had to have waited for that one episode of Cheers, for example. But now here we go. We've got, you can count on it. You know, you can set your watch by how gay Will and Grace is going to be.
Right. And also the fact that Will and Grace chose very specifically to explore a best friendship. Mm-hmm. A best friend between a gay man and a woman, you know, something that we've seen in movies and television throughout the years, of course, but like the nuance of that relationship is so special and so complicated and so like, you know, it's like, it's magical. Like every, you know, we all know that there's something really special that happens between, you know, a gay man who feels a real intense emotional connection to a woman and vice mm-hmm. versa. And just how kind of layered that can be and how intimate and like romantic at times, but also not, you know, and Will and Grace really, really opened up that whole Pandora's box, I think.
Isn't it interesting that that really is one of the first times we see it on television? And this seems so strange to say now, but it was really a revelation. It was a discovery that, oh, gay men and women are friends. Gay men and straight women are friends. Because we'd seen it a little bit in movies, My Best Friend's Wedding, An Object of My mm-hmm. Affection. But on television, it was sort of a new discovery that that was a phenomenon. In fact, there's a Entertainment Weekly has a whole, like, I think it was a cover story about it as Will and Grace is about to debut. Like, oh, hey, look at this. This is happening in a whole bunch of movies. And as that was happening, and what's the one? There's another one with Jack Nicholson and Greg Kinnear that I've forgotten. It's not The Opposite of Sex. Shoot. Anyway, there's a movie around the same time with the same dynamic. Anyway, Entertainment Weekly is like, hey, look at this. This is happening in movies. And the timing could not have been better for the Will and Grace team because they're looking at the box office returns for these films. And literally, as they were developing Will and Grace, they were sending the box office receipts to executives at NBC to prove, wow. like, see, well, this is validating. We're doing this. Wow. And we're going to be one of the first shows that does it. Because I'm honestly having trouble thinking of, like, it's such a cliche now, but the gay best friend trope on television prior to that, nothing is immediately coming to mind for me.
I really can't think of anything. And I think that made it, you know, had this been a show about Will, like, living with his boyfriend or his partner or his husband or whatever, it would have been a whole different thing. I think the fact that it was a relationship about two best friends, mm-hmm. you know, it made it so that other people, I don't know, I guess it made it so that people in like middle America weren't so put off by it.
That was absolutely the intent. There's actually a great Academy of Television interview with James Burrows, the director of, I think, every single episode. where it talks about when they were developing season one, something they did very intentionally in order to not alienate the middle part of the country, especially after that Ellen incident. I keep calling it the incident, the experience with Ellen, where people were like,
what better word for it?
That uh-oh, people don't want gay, people are scared of gay. Something that they did was in the pilot episode of Will and Grace, Will and Grace kiss. You know, they did in the pilot episode, she's been, she leaves this guy she's going to marry at the altar, realizing that he's not right for her. And so at the end of the episode, they share a kiss. At the end of the season, same thing. They bookend the season, season one, with a kiss. They kiss again under an altar. And, that was intentional to, suggest to audiences who might be on the fence, that Will and Grace might get together. They might realize that they actually are lovers and he might not be gay after all. Obviously, they didn't go that way. They had no intention of going that way. But they wanted people to think that that might be possible.
As a way to get people to watch and trick them. Yeah, that's amazing. Exactly.
And that's what the marketing, if you look at the ads that ran for Will and Grace in the 90s, it was very much a, they really seem to be wink, wink, nudge, nudging it. Like, oh, he's, I don't think they even say in some of the ads that he's gay. Just they're a couple of friends, and it seems like they're doing a Friends trick, because Friends was already on the air, of course, at that point. And it seems like they're doing a Ross and Rachel, where it's like, gosh, why won't they realize? And the nanny, why won't they realize that they love each other?
he can, you know? She can fix him.
Yeah, exactly. That's you know, that's a dynamic that worked on Cheers, for example, which Jim Burrows also directed a whole bunch of episodes of. And you can see, like, Will and Grace share a lot, I think, with Sam and Diane, in that there is a obstacle between them that prevents them from getting together as a couple. Now, the obstacle is much greater on Will and Grace.
Yes.
But also, these are also characters that are vulnerable in really interesting ways. Jim Burrows actually talks about this as well, with Ted Danson, with the Sam character. One of the ways in which he's vulnerable is his alcoholism. And with the Will character, one of the ways that he's vulnerable is that he's gay at a time that it is difficult for a person to be gay. These are obviously very different. He's not saying that the two are comparable.
Right.
But they fulfill similar roles in fleshing out that and deepening that character, in that this person has, you know, something that is going to present challenges to them. And I just think it's really interesting to hear the thoughtfulness with which Will and Grace was constructed.
Well, you can also, I mean, the Will and Grace conversation is layered, because then you can also kind of delve into the fact that at the time, you know, Will was sort of put on this, like, this pedestal of, like, oh, he's like the unattainable gay man. Like, he's the gay man that all gay men wish they could be. Like, you know, he's sort of straight presenting, he's handsome, you know, he's like just gay enough, in quotes, you know. And Jack, on the other hand, is just sort of like a juggling fool. Like, he is, you know, even though he was such an amazingly written character, so funny, played so well, you know, and all of those things, at the time it was like, you know, Jack is the joke. He's the gay man that you don't necessarily want to be, you know? He's, like, great for a party. He's a fun party trick, but you don't want to be Jack. You want to be Will. And it's funny the way that things have kind of turned now, where, like, people who rediscover that show or are rewatching the reboot or whatever, they love Jack. And Will is, like, this sort of representation of, like, toxicity, in a sense, in a lot of ways, the way that he sort of, like, berates Jack for being so flamboyantly gay. That's a funny thing too.
Yeah, you know, it's something that ages really interestingly, especially when you watch the series from, you know, over many years. In particular, in the beginning, Will has a lot of internalized homophobia to deal with, and Jack takes him to task for it in season one, and Will comes out. It's something like that, out at the gym or something like that. Anyway, Will uses the F slur at one point, and it's quite shocking. But it's also funny for me to hear you say that Jack is not the character that people want to be. Looking back, I certainly wanted to be thought of as funny and as entertaining and as outspoken, uninhibited as Jack.
Yes.
Free, exactly. Yeah, there. I think there are a lot of aspects of Jack that I envied.
Yeah,
when it was initially, when I caught it, you know, in its initial run. And yeah, I remember there being a lot of dissatisfaction from gay viewers saying like, oh, these are stereotypes. They're not realistic. There are no gay people are actually like this. And I remember when I was in college, I had a professor who he said something along the lines of, I can't believe how many gay people are lying about not knowing someone like Will and Jack.
That's great. That's
because so we do know those types.
Of course.
It was not a diverse show. Like there are a lot of white people on that show.
Oh yeah.
Same thing with a lot of sitcoms of the time. And there are certainly a lot of different gay experiences and queer experiences that were not represented. But I also think that it opened a door to, Ugly Betty and Glee, yes, and shows that had a little bit more diversity of queer experiences. It provided an opportunity for us to get used to Will and Grace. And now, well, how about this other kind of gay? There are other flavors out there. They don't all live in New York.
Right. And I love what you said, because honestly, it's like, me as a kid watching that and being like, if I had the fucking balls to bring a Cher doll to a fucking restaurant, I would do it, but I don't. Like, I wish, I wish. Oh my God. Like, I just thought he was so like funny and cool. And like you said, just kind of free. He was like my manic pixie dream girl, for me, it was Jack.
I think one of the other strengths with that character is, for all the like, oh, well, he's, he's making us look bad. There are also moments when Jack is told explicitly, not just by Will, but by other characters too, to rein it in. And he takes offense. He refuses to go along with it. And the people who are telling him to rein it in, they're clearly the bad guys. And I think that's incredibly powerful.
Well, speaking of that, I know we kind of touched on it for a second, but I do want to talk about Ellen for a second. Mm-hmm. We have to talk about Ellen and the gay trauma of the Ellen show and her coming out. What was that experience for you, like when that happened?
Wow, what an experience. Like, it was a national event. Like, there was not a single person who was not talking about this. And it rolled out very slowly, much slower than they wanted it to happen behind the scenes, actually. My experience was there were these rumors, there were rumblings, you'd see gossip. Ellen eventually came out, herself in real life, and then the episode happened. And I remember, I have a couple memories of it. One is that there were house parties happening all over the country, and you could send away to GLAAD for them to send you like an Ellen house party kit. They would send you like decorations and trivia games and stuff to do. I also remember that there were a lot of talk about television stations that weren't going to run the episode. I think it wound up happening that only a handful, maybe only even one, but very few refused to air the episode. But there was also, a lot of backlash. There were protests. I remember seeing on the news people marching outside ABC headquarters with signs that were mad that there was a lesbian on television. And, what a thing to internalize, that there's something about you that is so taboo, it shouldn't even be acknowledged as existing. That was very powerful. And then the cancellation was an incredible bummer, but also it was something that I think a lot of people saw coming. I watched for a few episodes after she came out so she comes out, there's one or two episodes left in the season. Then in the next season, I really didn't watch a whole lot because it kind of lost my interest. It was, at the end of the day, not as funny as it was. And still, I had honestly really liked the show prior, like in the seasons prior to that. There's an episode with Carrie Fisher that is quite beautiful. It's like a lovely episode. But the jokes didn't really land for me after that. Mm-hmm. And so I think there was sort of a sabotage that happened with the show not knowing what it was going to be after her coming out. I think there was a sabotage with ABC putting a warning on the show, and it seemed like ABC was actively pushing people away and not marketing the show. And I think that the gags not landing was, what did it in for me? It's a bummer. But I also think, by all accounts, Ellen was not the easiest person to work with. And so I think that there were a lot of people behind the scenes who were prepared for an opportunity to cut ties with her.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about her coming out specifically, and I guess the timing, like the time period, that very extremely specific sort of sliver of time, where people were, you know, Ellen was this phenomenon, right? She was this pop culture phenomenon. That show was the success of that show was like truly lightning in a bottle, you know? And it was that time when like comics getting a sitcom was a huge deal. That was the big money making thing. You know, you had the Cosby Show and you had Roseanne, which I do want to talk about before we end this episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a Roseanne conversation to be had.
Talk about frost.
But you know, it was just such as a specific time period, and it was like people were in a place of being okay with knowing you might be gay, but they weren't okay with you saying it.
Yeah, yeah. It's very like, as long as they don't rub my face in it kind of time.
Right.
And it's like, well, what constitutes rubbing your face in it? Like going on a date with somebody, like, saying that you're gay, wearing a pink tri- like, there's an incredible double standard of, you know, I was watching the show, you know, the show Ghosts on CBS. It's a relatively recent one based on a British show. Mm-hmm. So I was watching the show Ghosts, which a lot of people that I know and whose taste I like, they were recommending. And I found myself thinking, like, this show is really rubbing my face in how heterosexual the main couple is. And I was like, huh, I wonder if this is what it feels like when straight people watch gay stuff. Because they're not like doing that. Like, you know, they're just calling each other babe. And like, they're married. And I'm like, I'm so marinated now in gay media that when I just see a straight couple, I'm like, oh, do I have to flaunt it?
Yeah, it's like, we get it. You're straight.
Yeah. I think part of that, you know, part of that is because like, straight couples are all over the media, and I kind of feel like, oh, you've got a straight couple. I've seen that before. What else is new?
What else is there to say?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I totally get it. And I mean, it's funny because Ellen was like walking the same path as Rosie, who people talked about Rosie being gay. Like that was Rosie O'Donnell, yeah. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like it was never a conversation. Like, it was a conversation. It's just that because Rosie wasn't saying it, it was fine for her to be on TV as long as she didn't say the words. And Ellen had the exact same sort of relationship with people where it was like, nobody thought Ellen was dating men, but they didn't want to talk about it and they didn't want to hear about it and they didn't want to see it. They just wanted her to be funny in the way that felt safe to them. And nothing outside of that. And that's just it's so interesting that people were like, well, no, I'm not homophobic. I don't want to see it. Like that's the exact sort of time period.
There is a marvelous clip of Ellen appearing on Rosie's show right before the coming out, right before Ellen publicly came out. Mm-hmm. So they were still keeping everything under wraps. And Ellen had this like stock line that she was going to at the time where, and she uses this joke on every appearance where she says, oh no, it's all a misunderstanding. The character discovers she's Lebanese.
Yeah.
She likes Baba Ghanoush and she likes Casey Kasem or something like that. And she's Lebanese. And Rosie, she rolls this joke out that she's told a million times in front of Rosie. And you can see Rosie like light up and she's like, oh, you know what? I like Baba Ghanoush too. Maybe I'm Lebanese. And Ellen kind of cracks up at that because obviously they're both clocking each other. They know.
Yeah.
And so they're like, oh, well, we can't talk about this, but we're laughing about it. And that's, you know, it's this silly coding that had to happen that was absurd by that point. But it goes all the way back to, you know, the thing that makes me think of is the radio days of there was a show in the UK called Round the Horn. That was a radio show hosted by Kenneth Horne. And he had these two performers on, Kenneth Williams, and I forget the other actor's name, but Kenneth Williams, a very obviously ostentatiously homosexual performer.
Right.
And they would do this thing. They would never talk about being gay. They would never say anything explicit, but they would use the slang and they would be very, you know, it was hard to miss. They would speak, you know, Polari. Are you familiar with Polari?
I was going to say like, reminds me of the Morrissey song.
Yeah. And there's this one moment where they're playing they're playing shopkeepers, bookshop keepers. And Kenneth Horne's character comes in. He's very straight laced. He's very much the he doesn't tell the jokes. He's the butt of the jokes, and they're running circles around him. And he's asking for Shakespeare, and they're listing off the names of Shakespeare plays, but twisting the names with Polari. So it's two, you know, two Omi of Paloma or something like that. Or Verona, that's what I said, Paloma. Two Omi of Verona. And then one of them mentions the a play called, what does he say? As They Like It. And Kenneth Horne says, isn't it As You Like It? And Kenneth Williams says, well, not me personally, but Live and Let Live, I say. And, you know, it's a little moment. Yeah. If you know what they're talking about, you know what they're talking about.
Yes.
But they can't say it. And it's wild to me. Like, that's from the 1950s, I think, maybe 60s, that we're still playing that game. We're still doing that little tap dance in 1997 with Rosie and Ellen.
Well, because I think in the 90s, it was almost like appreciated. It was almost like, how clever can you do this? Like, people appreciated your clever take on not rubbing gayness in their face, but also hinting at it. And if you could do it really well, the way Rosie sort of did in this really, you know, like palpable middle America koosh ball-y kind of way, you know, people really respected that, which is such a weird thing.
I think they made fun of that to such great effect on Arrested Development with Tobias, you know, writing a book called The Man Inside Me and going to the Gothic castle, but someone mishears the Gothic castle. There's so many great jokes. And, you know, it really is making fun of that character who can't say it, who doesn't realize what they're saying. You know, it's all in code. But at this point, it's just absurd that we have to do this little dance.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, as queer people who lived through that experience, we'll probably never know like the level of trauma that had. Like, for me, when I think of the episode, I think of the clip playing over and over. I think it's like I can literally see it in my mind because I've seen the clip so many times just from it playing on the news of her like leaning over in the air in the microphone, and she's at the airport, and you know, it goes in the loudspeaker, and of course the Time magazine cover. I think of all that stuff, but I really think of her Oprah appearance. To me, her whole coming out experience can be summed up by going on the Oprah show, because I was a huge Oprah fan, and I came from an Oprah family. We watched Oprah every single day. And to see the way the audience turned on her was so, it was just so violent and so intense, and like, it was really scary. I think for me as like a kid, it was like at that point the most sort of violent gay thing I had ever seen. Just her sitting on that in front of the audience and having people scream stuff at her and like screaming like slurs at her and asking her like the most insanely inappropriate questions, and you know, Oprah talking about how they had like they had bomb threats that day, and you know, they were getting sniper threats, and you know, Ellen had to be snuck into the studio this special way because they were convinced people were going to kill her. And I mean, it's just crazy. Like, that was so, that lives in me. Like, I'm like having a That's So Raven moment now. You know what I mean? Like, that lives in like deep in my spirit.
Yeah. It really felt like, you know, it was like I forget the name of the author, but the guy who like had to come back on Oprah and defend himself from the making up stories in his book. You know, it was really like an explain yourself, like call to the principal's office kind of experience. Yeah. And especially like what's wild about that is how supportive Oprah was. Like, she was really like, she was totally on Ellen's side.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the audiences were just like, you know, if it's your first opportunity to interrogate a queer person, I agree that it was not done perhaps as delicately or considerately as it could have been.
Yeah, she's like, here's a microphone, audience. What do you want to say to this woman who just came out on Time magazine? It's like, what do you think they want to say? And then they also had people calling in. It's like, what do you think? You know, but I guess that was also like that time period for talk shows to like have just wild lightning in a bottle moments like that happen on stage.
I think Ellen does get a lot of heat for her interactions with other people and the way that she comports herself as a leader. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the objections are extremely legitimate. Also, I think it is possible to acknowledge, like you said, the trauma, going through an extremely difficult experience. I cannot begin to imagine processing a coming out on that level, especially after one of Ellen's, early experiences was her girlfriend, I think this was in the late 70s, died in a car crash. And it was a really difficult experience for Ellen. It was actually something that she turned into stand-up to process. If you've ever seen like early appearances of Ellen, she has this bit where she does like a phone call with God. And that started as her trying to process the death of her girlfriend. A piece of her life as a lesbian was so traumatic and upsetting for her so early in her life. I think that also informs how, the barriers that she put up, for better or for worse, between her and other people in her life.
Wasn't that the bit that got Johnny Carson to like call her over to the chair?
Yeah. Yeah. That was it. I can't even imagine how conflicted she must have felt like that. That, you know, it was something that was real and raw and very painful for her. And it also made her career.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. I don't think it's an accident that Oprah plays her therapist. And that part of the gag in that puppy episode is that she's going through one therapist after another. I'm sure that was Ellen's real life experience as well.
Oh God. Okay. Well, we're here. Can we have a nuanced conversation about Roseanne?
Yeah. Let's talk about problematic characters on television. She, like you said, there was part of this wave of giving comedians TV shows that sometimes worked, sometimes didn't. Mm-hmm. She certainly was not as, trouble, I think. And sometimes trouble in a good way, sometimes trouble in a bad way. But, even going back then, thinking about, her national anthem incident, where she really has a knack for making enemies. And sometimes I think she used that for good. And sometimes I think she used it for things that were not. Sometimes I think she used it for good. Sometimes I think she used it for things that are, the goodness is in the eye of the beholder. And sometimes I think increasingly now she has used it for things that are objectively pretty negative. Having been said, the Roseanne show, the show Roseanne, is not the person Roseanne. A lot of people worked on that show that were not her. And it is also a artifact of its time that is extremely important. So, it's hard to talk about Roseanne the person versus Roseanne the show and keep them separate. But I also think it is important to do because, there was a lot of good that came out of that show. And a lot of good that came out of her, particularly as a person, while also acknowledging a lot of bad.
That's an amazing way to put it. I think that's like, Roseanne is not the show. That's like, you could just sum all of it up with that, right? Mm-hmm. And so I have done a Roseanne episode of this podcast years ago. It was actually like maybe a month or so prior to the incident, like Roseanne's ambient incident. Yeah. The big one. It was like I'd done the episode to kind of commemorate like how much that show meant to me in the 80s and like the 80s version of it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I talked about how, Roseanne was a really tough one for me because growing up, Roseanne really like came to represent this like safe space, if anything. Like I really saw I didn't see my family in Roseanne, but I saw people that I recognized in the Roseanne show. And I still to this day think that, up to the point that things get weird on Roseanne, like, the mid 90s, like the lottery and all the things, where things get a little sharp jumpy, if you will. I think that, right? It's like, it's wild. The 80s version of Roseanne, I think, is still hands down to this day one of the best depictions of an American family on television that I've ever seen. I don't know if I've ever seen something so realistic or well-written. Mm-hmm. And Roseanne then it's so wild, like, what she represented for people during that time, you know, being this show that was, like, forward-thinking and showed an authentic family, a middle-class family, a woman who was, like, you know, considered overweight and a married to a man that was considered overweight, and they had an active sex life, and they were poor, and, you know, like, they, it was so relatable, and she had gay friends, and they weren't the joke, they were just gay people, and, you know, was it the first gay wedding on television?
It wasn't the first, but it was pretty early. Rock came earlier, and I believe Friends had theirs. I can't remember. Friends had theirs, like, it was the same month. And I can't remember which one was first, but they were on the forefront. It was real early. Leon and I can't remember the other character's name. Leon and his partner.
Yes, Leon. And those things all meant so much to me, like, throughout my whole life. And then, you know, Roseanne got older. And now she's this really staunchy, sort of wacky old woman. And I guess Roseanne's always been a wacky old woman in a lot of ways, but now she really has just gone off the deep end. And, you know, it's just sad. It's like she is the complete opposite of everything that, like, I wonder if 80s Roseanne had a conversation with Roseanne now, and she'd be like, who are you? Two completely different women.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true what you say about representing a group of people that you did not often see on television, that they were economically marginalized, but also had a lot of dignity. You know, at a time when, you know, shows, sitcom families tended to be very nuclear and wealthy in ways that were just like bananas. Like, oh yeah, of course we've got a live-in butler.
You know? Right. Yeah.
So many shows from that time have a housekeeper who lives with them. And it's like, what planet is this on?
Know,
like,
so
give
true.
Me a break, or Mr. Melody, of course, or even, you know, like Charles in Charge. Like, what? What are you kidding me? And here's, like, people who are living, like, and I think it's particularly noteworthy, and I think this is something that is often overlooked when you look at Roseanne, that a lot, especially in that first season, is about labor and union organizing, which is, like, that's amazing to have that, like, to have the union organizing be the hero turn, the arc of the season. What? Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you say, like, you know, they've got... she's got gay friends. It's not a big deal to her. They have a gay wedding on the show. It's somewhat of a big deal. And then, of course, the gay kiss that Roseanne has a kiss with Muriel Hemingway. That too, a very big deal, to the point where they didn't know it was going to air until it aired. You know, the network was pretty up in arms about that after 30 something, a year or two earlier, just showed two men in bed, not touching, not, you know, just sitting next to each other. And they lost a ton of money. I want to say it was like $10 million. I might be wrong about that. They lost a ton of money from advertisers, you know, pulling out.
And it was the first kiss, right?
It was. No? I think it might have been. I'm hesitant to say the first, but I think it might have been. Yeah. No, LA Law might have been earlier.
Okay.
But again, it was really like, it was right there as, you know, one of the very earliest.
Yeah,
you had LA Law, you had Picket Fences, you had a few others. Yeah,
yeah.
All around the same time, that's when networks discovered, the lesbian kiss episode for Sweeps Week. This is a real moneymaker. Yeah, for a while,
yes.
You know, Deep Space Nine, you'd see, and it was always a lesbian kiss. It was never men.
Of course. Well, men were like, we can handle that. I guess we can handle that.
The lesbian kiss, and then never again. It was never like the lesbian, you know, the couple that hooks up and stays together. It was like, we're experimenting, or you're here for a week and then you're gone forever.
Yes.
I think one of the first examples of that is it's just this incredible, I forget the name of it, there's a soap opera in the 80s where a woman comes out as lesbian, gets upset, runs out of the room into traffic, and is hit by a truck and killed.
Oh my god,
explicitly the kill your lesbians trope, like, it's so by the numbers, but it was one of the first cases of that. It really
Holy
set the template
shit.
For what would come. Yeah. So often with
wild.
Lesbians and gay characters, and, you know, but lesbians in particular, you'd see a lot of, there are a lot of dead lesbians on television for a couple of decades there.
Well, so not to skim over the Roseanne of it all, because I did just want to touch on it, and I did want to just, like, say, you know, that it more so just makes me really sad. Mm-hmm. Like, it really feels like a loss. I remember when that all happened, and even when Roseanne was, like, you know, she was, like, very pro-Trump, in her, like, on her Twitter and stuff, and she was like posting those like wild Nazi memes and stuff. And I always felt like at a certain point we had lost Roseanne. It felt like she had kind of given into her own mania at a certain point and just really became the sort of reclusive, like, wacky lady that I guess she was always destined to become. But I was blown away that the network had decided to put her back on TV. And it felt like it was this thing of like, don't be too Roseanne. It's like, this is not the same woman. And this show now represents something completely different than it did, you know, 30 years ago or whatever. But yeah, I just wanted to talk about the Roseanne because I haven't really mentioned her since I talked about her the last time.
I think you're right. Like, that nostalgia is very beguiling. And there is often a belief that we'll just get the same people back and put them in the same set. And it'll be just like it was, only with better cameras. And people change and times change. And yeah, that Roseanne, it was a Roseanne of the 80s and into the 90s was a moment that can't be recaptured. Because
exactly,
like you said, she's a different person. And the issues that they're tackling are different. I think it's the best way to remember that stuff is to watch the reruns and enjoy them and be happy for what we had. Even after she jumps that shark and just keeps on going up into the stratosphere.
Their biggest mistake was not just naming the show Jackie. I mean, honestly, the reboot should have been named Jackie and it should have been about Jackie because that's what we all secretly wanted.
Man,
we all want the Jackie show.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. Yeah, she's great.
You know?
But, you know, if you get those things back, it's never going to be what it was. And even what you remember and what you like about what it was isn't really what it was at the time. And, you know, and by you, I mean the general you, we as people, generally, we are different people than we were in the 80s. And so the way we see those things now is going to be very different. So anyway, I think the way to, it is really a bummer that she has, what she means to people now is very different. And I think, you know, what we can do is appreciate the good stuff that was left behind by that series when it was on. You know, acknowledge the problems with what we have today. But that doesn't diminish how wonderful that stuff from then is.
Yeah. Well, Matt, I want to end our conversation today by talking about a show that I think handles queerness just so fucking poorly. Just the complete opposite end of the spectrum is Friends.
Yep.
Friends is, I would say, in modern times, one of the, in a show that remains so popular, you know, it remains one of the most watched shows in syndication, is always streaming. You constantly hear new generations of people discovering Friends. They're excited to rewatch it and tell people. I personally can't figure out why. I do not find Friends to be a timeless show, and I do not find the writing to be timeless, but that's just me. Much more of a living single girl myself. That's all I'm saying. But let's talk about the queerness covered on Friends.
Yeah. I mean, first I want to say, I agree. Living Single, I think, is a superior show in down to how they handle queer stuff. But Friends, that is one that, you know, it's an interesting one to talk about because one of the creators is gay. And so, and gayness has just been baked into the show from the beginning, in part because of Ross's ex-wife and also because of Chandler, who was going to be gay up until a point. And then they cast Matt Perry and, you know, was it Matthew Perry? Yeah, Matthew Perry. When they cast him, they went in a different direction. But there's always sort of a simmering undercurrent of gay. And it's often, you know, that outsider perspective, which is so strange because I've forgotten his name, but one of the gay creator, you know, it shouldn't feel like the straights looking from behind the glass at the gays in their enclosure. And yet that is
exactly
often how it
what
comes
it
out.
Feels like. Yeah. It's the complete opposite of what we talked about with the nanny, where jokes do not feel inside. They don't feel, you know, in this particular case, the call is not coming from inside the house. It's coming from next door. And the connection is fuzzy at best. You know what I mean? Like, it's a really, really, really sort of, and it also does the thing of like, I can't even count how many times I remember on that show hearing somebody say like, yeah, gay, are you? What are you, gay? You know,
oh, there's so many. And it's always a bad thing. Yeah, it's ridiculous. You know, you look at in particular in the first season, they had to address how gay Chandler seems,
yeah,
because the character was initially conceived of as gay until he wasn't. And so that became such a thing. There's one episode, and I forgot the name of it. Oh, the one where Nana dies twice. That's the episode. Because the A plot is their grandmother dying. The B plot is Chandler. Somebody assumes that he's gay. And so they have to go through this whole process of debunking that. It's just wild. And it's always like, and he takes offense. It's always, why do you think that about me? And you mustn't, please, yes, don't. And
yeah,
they,
yes,
don't
totally
have, they don't do what Seinfeld does a few years later. The Nana episode is 94, and Seinfeld's, not that there's anything wrong with that, is, when is that? That's a little bit later. I think it's just a year later, actually. Actually, now that I think about it, it might even have been a year earlier. It's just right around the same time. Like, I think it's within like a year or two. And Seinfeld very clearly saying, oh no, the homophobia is the funny part here, not the, yeah, mistake that we're gay. And but no, yeah, Friends just goes right for it and like, haha, someone thinks you're gay. that's the joke. And then that joke is repeated many times throughout the run of the show. To their credit, they also have the lesbian wedding, which I think is very nice and very lovely, and you know, that's a positive depiction of a gay character. But also, the actresses later said they weren't allowed to kiss. NBC did not permit them to have a kiss in that episode, which is unfortunate. And so when they did, you know, the times when they did talk about, you know, get a little bit closer to the reality of queer people's lives on Friends, when it wasn't derogatory, it was something that they slipped in. Like, for example, there's an episode where Ross comes over and the Carol, his ex-wife, is insinuating that it's a bad time and she's with her partner and they're busy. And at one point she picks a hair out of her mouth. It's not commented on. It's not, you know, it's not highlighted, but she has said later that they had to like sneak in dirty little jokes like that because they couldn't talk more openly, God, about the fact that, oh, these women have sex.
It's just so like, I personally feel like Friends, when it comes to stuff like that, they often pull the lowest hanging fruit to me.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels like, oh, like it just makes you do that. It just makes you like, oh God, you know, like a lot of times I find when I'm watching that show, I'm mostly just tilting my head and shaking it. I'm not really laughing. And, you know, even with stuff like the intimacy between Chandler and Joey, it always has to be played into this, like, you know, like anything, any intimacy between them as friends has to be played as like a big joke because that's gay. It's gay shit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You know, that these two guys live together and they have a close friendship is automatically assumed to there's a misunderstanding that could happen here. And it's funny because of how embarrassed they are about it.
Yes.
It's, you know, the time for that has passed, I think, by 90 something when those episodes are on the air.
Yeah, it's like the perfect example of it to me is like how often you'll see like I guess it would be Joey like jumping into Chandler's arms. Like, you know what I mean? Being caught by him, and like the joke is that they're doing something like they're doing something emotionally vulnerable with each other, you know, and it's like it's gay shit.
Oh my God, yeah, that toxic so masculinity, like, that,
yeah,
obviously it hasn't gone away, but it was really like there were a couple things that were considered like the most insulting thing you could do about, you know, the 90s loved a make fun of the gays joke. They loved a make fun of a fat person joke.
Oh, they loved
a make fun of a woman for not being feminine enough joke. Gender roles and body policing was it was real funny, like,
yeah,
by which I mean it wasn't, but I think that those were the easiest, hackiest jokes to make back then. And there were a lot of sitcoms that were not immune to the temptation to go to that very shallow well.
The shallow well is the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Well,
I think we're in a much better place now when we've got like a Modern Family, for example, you know, that a show that is written with, you know, a return to that authenticity that you're talking about with The Nanny. That is clearly a couple that is written by people who know gays, who are gay, who have gay people in and around their lives. And so I think we can appreciate what we've got now while also acknowledging, you know, TV depictions of gays waxes and wanes. It goes through cycles. It has ups and downs, and we've been through ups before. We've been through downs before. And I think it is important for us to recognize that we can lose the positive depictions as easily as we, much more easily than we gain them. Remarking on the good and preserving it and highlighting it, I think, as you're doing on the show, is very important.
That's beautifully put. You took the words right out of my mouth. I was thinking, I have a lot of younger people that listen to this show. And, when it comes to seeing queer characters on TV, it feels like right now, networks, they've turned the other page where it's like now there's this excitement about incorporating as much queerness into your show as you can, and mm-hmm. doing it in all these different nuanced ways. You have shows like Euphoria and, it's very common now, but it really wasn't that long ago, like at all. Like I'm 34 years old and I remember being like in college and seeing these things older than college. Like it was very, very recently that, it was still very nuanced and very complicated and a lot of shows weren't doing it as well as the examples that we've given today. Mm-hmm. So like you said, it can very easily be taken away. And, it's a wild thought, but it could happen.
I do think, there are a lot of red flags and warning signs right now, as we're recording this in 2022. In the past, culture, because of capitalism, has followed politics often, not always. And in the 1970s, you saw a surge of gay stuff and then a real freezing out because politically it became unpopular around the mid-70s. And then a return to gay stuff around the late 70s when the politics shifted again. And then a freezing out again with the election of Ronald Reagan and then a slow return over the 80s. And so that's what I mean. Like it waxes and wanes, it comes and goes. Politics often informs it. Politics right now is worrisome. And I think, as viewers, something that we can do is be vocal in our approval of gay representation that is done well.
I think
that is important
so
for reasons other than just because we like our shows. I think it is important, politics, culture follows politics and also follows the audience. So as an audience, we can use our voices to guide what we want to see on television.
I couldn't have said it better, and I just fucking appreciate you, and I'm so happy that you, I'm so grateful that you wanted to do this with me. I really enjoyed this conversation, and like I said, I love your YouTube channel. Anybody listening to this, please go check out Matt's YouTube. It is so good. If you're a YouTube girl, which many of you are, it's just so easy to get lost in your videos. Like, autoplay, let it rip. Go for it, gal.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Yeah, you can find all my stuff on YouTube, Matt Baum. You can also, honestly, one of the easiest ways to find my stuff is go to gaysitcoms.com and that will have, that'll link you to my newsletter. You can get on my newsletter, link you to my YouTube channel, link you to my other projects. I have a podcast called The Sewers of Paris where I talk about gay stuff. So gaysitcoms.com will get you there.
Amazing. Well, thank you again for doing this with me.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for inviting me.
You are so very welcome. I hope that you guys enjoyed it and I will see you next week. Bye. Thank you for listening to Dunzo. This podcast is a part of the Solid Listen Network. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. Also be sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/solidlisten for exclusive content. You can follow me on Twitter at Troy McGee, and you can follow the podcast on all forms of social media at Dunzo Pod. That's D-U-N-Z-O. Thank you to executive producer Molly McAleer and coordinating producer Nicole Matthew.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.